This is Rabbi Josh Yoder of the Stanton Street Shul. Thank you for downloading this class podcast. These classes are provided free of charge through the generosity of the Stanton Street Shul community and supporters like you. If you do enjoy them, please consider making a donation to our synagogue's building fund on our website's shop donate page at www.stantonstshul.com. Good morning. It is Sunday, May 6, 2012. Sunday class wanted to shift gears a bit to discuss the halachic process, or how halacha works. And today's going to be a bit of an introduction to explain exactly what are the problems, because, you know, right off the bat, can say that the topic itself is kind of almost pretentious to even suggest. So it's, what do you mean how halacha works? Like, I'm going to tell you exactly this is the halachic process. Because you do a, you know, almost a cursory view, even just today, you see just how Jewish practice differs from community to community, from region to region. You've got a lot of different approaches to that Jewish law. Who am I the one to say, you know, here is what, you know, how Jewish law is supposed to work? Although you can take it a step further, which we, you know, are going to see about, you know, what is the purpose of halacha, which I will throw out here. Let's start out that question. What is the purpose of halacha?
To subjugate the Jews to all sorts of laws.
Yes, exactly.
Well,
that's exactly why we're here.
That could be the end result of things, but what is the purpose of, like, subjugating the laws? Like, ultimately, you know,
To give us a uniform, well, I don't want to say reference, but a uniform code of application of what the Torah tells us.
There you go. And we'll flesh those ideas out, but when you, you know, bring it back to the Torah, you're bringing it back to God. So technically,
assuming,
yes, I'm going, like, I will always make that assumption. The truth is, a lot of what we're going to do in this class is, there are things that we kind of discuss in the Fundamentals of Judaism 1. And one of the things that we did that I think worked well is that once we set up certain assumptions, you know, or at least develop them, you know, keep them in the forefront. Yes, we are going to assume for this class the existence of God and the divinity of the Torah. That's one of my bases here. Mm. But what that means, though, is that from a halachic perspective, when you're dealing with the statement of, like, well, a Rabbi X says Y, or any time a rabbi says this is the halacha, implied somewhere buried there is God wants you to do something. If you take it all the way up the logical chain of, like, well, you know, this is the law. Why? Because this rabbi said so. Because that rabbi said so. And you always have to work it all the way back up. What are all about these assumptions in rabbinic authority? Well, trust me, this is things that we're going to develop over time. But first, I wanted today to lay out a couple of issues about what is the law, some of the difficulties we have with Jewish law, and to actually go through a non-Jewish source to give some sort of context about how we're going to discuss legal matters. So in the first section, I tentatively titled this The Problem of Jewish Sources, but I want to get one point across here. If people quote any particular source halachically, like if I ask you what's the law in a particular matter, I say this is the law. You say, how do you know that? I quote you a source. Right. There's an implication there that this source is legally binding in some way. And one of the problems with that type of assumption is that there is a source that Jews actually follow with any shred of consistency, and the answer is we don't. So let's take one, and I want to give a few examples here about when Jews and conventionally don't follow big opinions. And by conventionally, I mean, you're going to find people who will actually follow the sources that I list, but these are not going to be the most popular practices that you're going to find around in Jewish communities. Right? So let's start with the first one, Rambam. And these are somewhat arbitrary that I picked out. I only picked out, you know, four of the big ones, Rambam, Shulchan Aruch, Rambam, Mishneh Berurah. You've got a lot of other halachic sources that come up, but there too, you know, spend enough time with it, you're going to find something that a particular rabbi or source says that people don't do. So the answer is, I'm not saying that, you know, no one ever follows them, but I'm saying that there is no singular source that Jews follow consistently by 100%, which means that when you give an argument of follow this particular rabbi, there's going to be an exception. And it's those exceptions that you need to tease out. Well, what's really driving your halacha? Is it the authority, in, which is going to be one of our themes in this class, is it the authority of this particular rabbi, like something innate, or the authority come from some other source? So let's take Rambam. Rambam is a great example of something that people quote really selectively, not just in terms of the 13 principles of faith, a whole bunch of stuff. When it comes to women leadership positions, Rambam's usually the go-to person where people say women are not allowed to have any sort of authority. But, you know, the joke that we used to, like me and a few friends might say, yeshiva, when people would quote the Rambam, you would say, you know, the Rambam says a lot of things. And take us with source number one here. This is from Rambam's Hilchot Megillas in Chanukah 3:7. This is regarding the laws of Halal.
And those places where they keep 2 days of Yontav outside of Israel, they complete the Hallel 21 days as opposed to 18.
The parentheses are things that I added in. Following the Gemara here about how many days during the year you're supposed to see Hallel. So in this section, you know, the first one is if you, you know, are in Israel, you got three fewer days of Yom Tov. So if you're out, you've got three more days. So he actually lists them out here. Continue.
On the 9 days of the holidays,
meaning it's Sukkot and Shemini Atzeret.
8 days of Hanukkah, 2 days of Passover, and 2 days of Shavuos. But on the new months, the reading of Hallel is a custom and not a commandment. And this custom is only in public and only done with omitting portions. And we do not make a blessing, for we do not make blessings on customs and individuals.
It's on customs, comma, and individuals, meaning not a minion.
Not a minion. Do not read Hallel at all. And if he began reciting it alone, he completes with the omissions as he would in a minion, and so too for the remaining days of Passover. It is read with omissions like the new months.
So according to Rambam, you don't say Hallel with a blessing on Rosh Chodesh. And if you're davening by yourself without a minion, according to Rambam, you don't say Hallel at all.
We don't paskin like that.
That's exactly my point. When you say we don't paskin like that, what is implied? So my point here is that, well, clearly, Jewish practice doesn't follow Rambam 100% of the time. Right? Because here's clearly an example. Let's take it to Shulchan Aruch. Right? Rav Yosef Karo. Go ahead.
Can I try the Hebrew?
Yeah, just translate it. I apologize if it's not clear. I have to replace the toner in my printer.
Ein is a
mitavchin
lahakos kaf al kaf. The lo mis...
Translate after each of the commas.
Oh, okay. One does not clap on Shabbos and Yom Tov.
Yep.
The lo mas...
Misapkin.
Misapkin, thank you. Lahakos kaf al yarech. And one does not slap one's thighs. Below Meraktin, Gezerah Shema Yitaken Kleshir.
You're right. And what's Meraktin?
Well, dance.
Yeah.
One does not dance, lest one come to fix a musical instrument.
Well, yes.
That's a jump.
Well, that's somewhat of a you joke there,
but that
is actually one of the kfitza. Anyway, it's Yerushalmi involved. So, according to Shulchan Aruch, following Gemara in Beitza Lamed Amud Aleph and Lamed Vav Amud Bet, it is forbidden rabbinically to clap your hands and dance on Shabbat and Yom Tov. Because, well, first off, it's the Mishnah that you'll find in Lamed Vav Amud Bet says it is forbidden to dance and clap on Shabbat, implied to Shabbat and Yom Tov. The Gemara explains, Shema Yitakin Klishir, lest you come to fix a musical instrument. And Shulchan Aruch continues with banging, actually extends beyond what's limited in the Mishnah. The Mishnah only describes clapping. The Mishnah only describes, like, clapping, dancing, and slapping the thighs. Shulchan Aruch actually extends it a little bit further to banging your finger against a ground or a board or snapping, rattling nuts or things along the likes, all under the same rubric. But he does say you're allowed to clap backhanded. And you'll notice myself and a few other people in the show clap along. Clap like this, which, by the way, if there are any women listening, take off your rings before you do that. I'm told it's very painful when you try clapping. Anyway, so here is, according to Shulchan Aruch, not allowed to clap and dance on Shabbos. Wow, or Yom Tov, which ostensibly would include Simchas Torah. Now, do Jews follow this?
The more rules you learn, the more enslaved you are.
Well, it's not a matter
of... You don't want to know these things.
It's not a matter of being... You know, that's actually a funny thing that you mentioned. Because when the Gemara actually cites this halacha in Beitza, it uses... it's part of a discussion of Mutafyu Shogigim V'al Yumezidim, that there was a rabbi who saw people that were dancing on Shabbat, and he didn't say anything. So people asked, "Oh, so does this mean it's okay?" He said, "No, they're not going to listen to me, and better they sin in error rather than sin intentionally." So this is actually the source in the Gemara, or at least this is a case where that's actually discussed. Mm-hmm. Now, clearly, Jewish practice doesn't follow this. Why? So read where it says Ramah in the English. This is based off of a Tosafot in Beit Olamed Amid Aleph.
Okay, and some say that today it is all permitted because we are not experts in making music instruments, and there is no reason for this enactment lest one come to fix a musical instrument, for it is uncommon. And it's possible because of this reason that the custom is to act permissively.
Let me explain this. So this already goes back to the Tosafot, earlier than the Ramah, who said that, you know, in their day, when they knew how to fix musical instruments, Shayach LeMigzar, it made sense to have such a decree. Today, that we don't know, Lo Shayach LeMigzar. You just don't know, so it doesn't apply anymore. That halachic rationale, we'll see a little bit in subsequent weeks, is even Tosafot applies that inconsistently. But the logic is batel ta'am batel gezerah. If the reason is no longer applicable, then the halacha itself is no longer applicable.
So how come there's no music on Shabbos?
Time out here. You're all asking phenomenal questions here. One step at a time. First step here is to show that Shulchan Aruch says you're not allowed to dance and clap on Shabbat. So point one of why I included this is to show just one example where conventional practice does not follow Shulchan Aruch. Why? Because the Ramah adds a particular, or he rules in accordance with a certain dispensation based on Tosafot, an earlier source. Now, there's a little bit more here to it. The Mishnah Bura says that, what actually makes a distinction, who says that, well, you know, you shouldn't do it during the rest of the year, but we'll give a dispensation specifically for Simchas Torah. Beit Yosef, which is the same person as the Shulchan Aruch, actually addressed that point years earlier. I think he was responding to the Maharik of Cologne, who gave a similar response, and the Beit Yosef said, Manavshach, like, make up your mind. If you're concerned with the Gemara, it's forbidden all year round. If you follow the Tosafot's dispensation, that if the reason is no longer applicable, then the Gzeirah doesn't apply anymore, well, then it should be permitted all year round. I mean, to say that we're only going to rely on Tosafot for Simchat Torah seems to be inconsistent. Like, if Tosafot is correct, it's fine all year round. If Tosafot is incorrect, then it's forbidden all year round. There's no special distinction by Simchat Torah. So yeah, that's a little bit, you know, more on this particular topic. Again, for the point of this conversation, Shulchan Aruch rules no dancing. Ramah says, sure, it's okay. Conventionally, what, you know, in colloquial discourse amongst Ashkenazi yeshivot, you'll find a common refrain of, well, Ashkenazim don't follow the Shulchan Aruch, only Sfardim follow the Shulchan Aruch, Ashkenazim follow the Ramah. And have anyone else here heard this? You must have heard this at some point.
Doesn't sound familiar.
Really? No one told you Ashkenazim follow the Ramah?
Not to the exclusion of the Shulchan Aruch, no.
No, that's an interesting point there. So the question is, when do you follow which? So in this particular case, practice seems to follow Ramah over Shulchan Aruch, right? Then take number three, please. This is Shulchan Aruch Orachaim 31.2, that describes putting on tefillin on Chol HaMoed. So the Shulchan Aruch says,
on Chol HaMoed it is also forbidden to put on tefillin for this reason. For Chol HaMoed is considered an oath, a sign. The Ramah says, and some say that on Chol HaMoed one is obligated in tefillin. And this is the practice in all these regions, to put on tefillin on Chol HaMoed and to bless on them, but not to make a blessing over them loudly in shul, as is normally done during the rest of the year.
Right. So you go to most shuls today, people don't put on tefillin on Chol HaMoed. observe this? I mean, we just finished Pesach, but like you'll have to wait around until, you know, Sukkot, but, you know, keep an eye out for it. In most shuls, or at least that I've attended, men don't put on tefillin.
I thought it was follow your father's minhag.
Well, that's a whole separate issue. I mean, right, the main, not wrong, that gets into the, you know, minhag thing here, right? The minhag that, you know, I tried to establish for the shul was that some people do, some people don't. Minhag of the shul is do whatever you are more comfortable with, right? Because, you know, here they've got different opinions. Dominant opinion is not to, or at least practice, in terms of practice, which means that the common Ashkenazi practice does not follow Ramah on this particular issue. So you've got one case that we cited, you know, in number two, which was, sorry for not mentioning it earlier, is Shulchan Aruch Or HaChaim 3393, regarding dancing on Shabbos. Practice, conventional practice, tends to follow Ramah over Shulchan Aruch. Regarding putting tefillin on Chol HaMoed, practice seems to follow Shulchan Aruch over Ramah. Which means that it's not anything intrinsic of, you know, Shulchan Aruch or Ramah that describes what people do, but there's something else at play. And I threw in its source number four here, a Mishnah Berurah from Or HaChaim 2336 on something called Tarte Desatre that comes up regarding what time we daven Mincha and Maariv. Most shuls, and I say most because there are exceptions, I think Bialystoker is one of the exceptions here, that daven Mincha and Maariv in quick succession during a weekday. Meaning, you've got like a mincha, you say right before sunset, you know, and then after sunset, you like have maybe a quick Dvar Torah in there, or you might even just go straight into Maariv. According to the way that Mishnah Berurah phrases this, is something called Tarte Desatre. There's a dispute in Gemara and Barachot, what is the appropriate time for Mincha and the appropriate time for Maariv? I believe it's Rabbi Yehuda and Chachamim. And our practice is usually, or for the ones who do it in quick succession, is you rely on one opinion for Mincha and you rely on the other opinion for Maariv. As opposed to davening, you know, if you want to daven an early Maariv, or relatively early Maariv, you have to daven Mincha by plag Mincha, way before halachic sunset. So here's a case where conventional practice doesn't even follow Mishnah Berurah. And, you know, maybe there are better examples when conventional practice doesn't follow Mishnah Berurah. But the ultimate point is that for any source that I can cite you, if you ask me for a halachic question, and I trace it back to there, and I want to rely on the authority of a particular source, with enough research, anyone can find a source that practice doesn't follow. Or an example that I've given, if not actually one of the classes here, but I've told other people who are just getting into halacha, if you pick up your typical Art Scroll or Feldheim halacha book, before you even get to the body of the text, you look at the footnotes, and you see how many different people and sources are quoted. A great question to ask is, why are you quoting this source here, this source there, and this source there? What if I use these same sources and I quote them to address different concerns? Right? And when you see a lot of diversity quoted in the footnotes, you have to ask that question. Why are you choosing these particular sources in these particular cases?
Because the editor has an agenda.
No, how about it's a don't try this at home, I'm a professional.
Fine, but you have to ask what's your methodology. Why are you following one source here and one source there? Now, you say there's an agenda. That's not entirely wrong because you're getting to a certain predetermined conclusion for what you think it is. But there are a lot of assumptions there about what drives halacha. And these are the types of things that I want to really get at, which is when people make a whole bunch of statements about, well, this rabbi says, what are the underlying assumptions behind it? And how does halacha, I mean, well, I don't think how halacha really work, but there are a lot of assumptions that people just take for granted. And I want to try to unpack a lot of these assumptions that people make. When they say, a rabbi says X, what's assumed under there?
The reason they say that is because they want to say X. So they add, a rabbi says X, to make it stronger.
Fine. So the truth is, you are touching on an interesting point that we're going to try to avoid, which are tautologies. A tautology is something that is self-referentially true, or a way of saying, well, it's right simply because it is. Right, so to say, well, this is halacha because this is what Jews do, right, is going to be more, I mean, unless you actually play, you know, there's going to be something tautological there of a way of saying, well, it's another way of saying, well, what we do is always going to be correct. Because, well, otherwise, I mean, you know, if this is the practice, it must be right because this is what Jews do. And we're going to see statements that you know, kind of say something along those lines. Yeah.
Well, this may not have much scholarship behind it, but there are a lot of people who say, well, this is how we do it in B'nai Brak, which is known for being machmer in a lot of areas where the rest of the world might not be.
All right, so we say they do it in B'nai Brak. What are the assumptions behind it?
That somebody is bringing over their own minhag or tradition.
That's one. An assumption is that what they do in B'nai Brak matters, that other people should care about. What B'nai Brak does, or are arguing that what's done in a particular community is in fact a legitimate source of Jewish law. That's an assumption there. Where do you get that assumption?
Well, I guess you believe that they are A, devoted to halacha, and B, very knowledgeable.
Okay, and is that always true statements? Or is it based on belief? How do you determine that belief? Right? And every time you ask a question, it's going to beg another question down the line.
Well,
where are you going to get all this from?
Well,
and this is what this class is going to be about. And trying to develop it from the sources and to see where you may have some divergences. And to see, well, what are the assumptions behind these divergences and what may make more sense or not. In order to help, you know, explicate this, you know, for the other sources in the class, wanted to actually cite a book from Hans Kelsen called The Pure Theory of Law. And the reason being, it's going to give us a certain type of vocabulary to conceptually understand what goes on in the legal process. Right? Because we can go around in circles and, you know, say, well, why about this? What about that? I can cite a biblical verse. What about interpretations? We need to start somewhere. So we need to, I think, begin with some idea, an approach to law. Now, we're not going to, you know, cover the whole book, but this is at least, you know, the introductory parts where he talks about norms and what's the difference between, you know, say, a legal norm and a social norm. Okay? And as we go through this, try to keep in mind certain applications as this may pertain to a halachic system, right? Because, you know, Ed, you know, can put it, you know, cynically as possible of like, well, this is just a means of control. But in truth is, any legal system is going to be a means of control. The government, the United States government, tells you what you can and can't do. Your state government tells you what you can and can't do. Any legal system sets up rules and regulations by which they enforce a certain type of behavior. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you know, there are questions about how exactly, you know, whence does all this derive? So let's start us off when he actually, in this paragraph, he describes the norm as a scheme of interpretation. Let me run through this a little bit quickly, where he describes external fact whose objective meaning is a legal or illegal act is always an event that can be perceived by the senses because it occurs in time and space, and therefore a natural phenomena determined by causality. However, this event as such and as an element of labor, a nature, is not the object of legal cognition. What turns this event into a legal or illegal act is not its physical existence determined by laws of causality prevailing in nature, but the objective meaning from its interpretation. Meaning, in plain English, I cross the street against the light. By virtue of just me crossing the street doesn't make it illegal. Something has to happen to make it illegal by means of interpretation. The specifically legal meaning of this act is derived from a, quote, norm, whose content refers to the act. This norm confers legal meaning to the act so that it may be interpreted according to this norm. In other words, there has to be something that was done, which he calls a norm. To put it differently here, I'll actually continue. The judgment that an act of human behavior performed in time and space is legal or illegal is the result of a specific, namely normative, interpretation. Something has to happen in order to turn my action of walking against the light to give it that adjective illegal. All right, make sense so far?
Yeah.
Actions themselves are not legal or illegal unless something happens to make it so.
Like it being documented.
Or like being, let's say, a formal act of legislation, for one, or whatever source that you're dealing with, that's what he calls a norm. This is in a very abstract sense here. Yeah.
No, when you said something has to happen.
Yes.
I mean, to me, it key is something has to be written.
That's a way of a norm. That certainly could happen. That is a type of norm. But his first point is, in order for something to be determined illegal, something has to happen, right? Or at least there has to be something done. So the question in Jewish law would be, what makes something, let's say, asur? What makes this action prohibited? What are those associated norms? Take us to the next paragraph. It says norm and norm creation. We're skipping a bit of what's in the source sheets, but I encourage people to read on their own. It's a bit of a philosophical work, but you know, it's not unreadable. So go ahead.
Those norms, then, which have the character of legal norms and which make certain acts legal or illegal, are the objects of the science of law. The legal order, which is the object of this cognition, is a normative order of human behavior, a system of norms regulating human behavior. By norm, we mean that something ought to be or ought to happen, especially that a human being ought to behave in a certain, a specific way. This is the meaning of certain human acts directed toward the behavior of others. They are so directed if they, according to their content, command such behavior, but if they permit it, and particularly if they authorize it. Authorize means to confer upon someone else a certain power, the power to enact norms himself. In this sense, the acts whose meaning is a norm are acts of will. If an individual by his acts expresses a will directed at a certain behavior of another, that is to say, if he commands, permits, or authorizes such behavior, then the meaning of his acts cannot be described by the statement that the other individual will, future tense, behave in that way, but only that he ought to behave in that way.
Meaning he's saying that, so the main description here is, by a norm, means something ought to happen, and describing ought as a means of saying, here's the actions that we expect someone to do. Let me skip ahead a bit. The word ought here is used in the broader than usual sense. According to customary usage, ought corresponds only to a command, while may responds to permission and can to authorization, but in the present work, ought is used to express the normative meaning of an act directed towards the behavior of others and includes may and can. Right? So it's you're giving sort of a legal context here. Continue on the next page with a paragraph that with norm. This is a very important paragraph here.
Norm is the beginning, is the meaning of an act by which a certain behavior is commanded, permitted, or authorized. The norm, as the specific meaning of an act directed toward the behavior of someone else, is to be carefully differentiated from the act of will, whose meaning the norm is.
Who's meaning the norm?
Really know how to speak clearly.
No, he's using when I typed this up, I scanned this in from the book, so it's missing a few of the italics. Mm. He's making a distinction between is and ought. So the is here is actually meant as a specific entity, not as a state of being. He'll explain. Finish the paragraph.
Where was I when I?
Hence
the situation constituted by such an act must be described by the statement that one individual wills that the other individual ought to behave in a certain way. I would throw in, and then you have to be suspicious. Who is the first
he actually goes and develops all this in the course of a book.
The first part of the sentence refers to an is, the existing fact of the individual's act of volition, the second part to an ought, to a norm, as the meaning of that act. Therefore, it is incorrect to assert, as is often done, that the statement an individual ought merely means that another individual wills something, that the ought can be reduced to an...
Oh, I'm sorry. So the OCR didn't pick
missing,
that up. Ended off the paragraph. I'll have to fix that in the source sheet. This is where he makes a distinction in his terminology of what is and what ought to be. An ought, well, let's take the is. The is would refer to a particular action, right? Me crossing the street against the light. That's an is. That's observable. This is something I'm doing. The ought refers to, is this, let's say, for in our terms, legal or illegal, right? So let's take one of our early examples. An is statement would be Jews dance on Simchas Torah. Now, the ought would be is that halachic or is that not halachic? And there is a distinction between those two types of statements here. He continues in another paragraph here, gives a distinction between the door is being closed and the door ought to be closed, would be a difference. Now, even though the two may in fact, you know, if the door is closed, right, the end result is still the same, they both convey very different meanings. One, you know, would be more of, you know, as you would, you know, call it the normative of like, here's what you are supposed to do. And the other is going to be, well, just describing what is in fact going on. And as he writes in another paragraph, their behavior as it actually takes place may or may not be equal to the behavior as it ought to be. But equality is not identity. The behavior that is the content of the norm, that is the behavior that ought to be, and the actual behavior are not identical, though one may be equal to the other. Meaning, you can't say because it is, therefore it ought to be. That would be a matter of identity. When you say something that is identical, it means that swapping one, when you swap one for the other, you can use them interchangeably, and the meaning is still the same. You know, do people get that distinction here between
sure.
equality and identity? Equality could mean the two things may have the exact same value, but that doesn't mean that they're easily substitutable, that one means the other, and you can use those terms interchangeably. So when I say the door is closed and the door ought to be closed, yes, the door could still be closed in both scenarios, but they mean very different things.
Mm-hmm.
Get that?
Easy. Partly it seems obvious. I'm not sure what he's saying. But on the other hand,
you say it seems obvious.
The B'nai Brak example.
Bingo! That's exactly the point. The B'nai Brak example means why it's not obvious, or at least there's a whole lot implied there. Right? When I say they do it in B'nai Brak, that's an is statement.
It's not an ought statement.
It's an observable.
It's implying an ought statement.
Bingo! It is implying an ought statement. And if you want to say it's an ought statement, you have to justify where does that ought come from. Right.
The implication is that they know what they're doing, but they drop the phone.
Or there's some other, you know, halachic issue behind it.
Or that adhering to Jewish law in the strictest possible way is always the way to go.
Well, that's something else entirely, because I'm, you know, maybe there are kulot, there are leniencies. You know, if you're strict in one area, you could be lenient in another. Yeah, you know, he skipped a bunch of other, you know, paragraphs here about, you know, where he goes through a few distinctions. Like he gives an example of, you know, if I were to, you know, get 12 other people, and we would decide to like kill someone, you know, because we don't like what they do. Let's say, I don't know, we're, you know, rabid New York fans and we hate the Boston Red Sox.
They put Phil on.
Or they put Phil on, or any of, you know, these
I'm
sorts of things.
Yeah.
You know, we could even, actually, you know, we could still even go through, you know, the same, you know, type of process of like, you know, that any other court would do, but, you know, we would today call such a thing murder. Because, again, there's this, not just a certain ought in terms of what we think things ought to do, but an ought in terms of, like, how even norms are simply created. You know, that goes to, like, who are the, you know, who are the deciding bodies. Could you continue with the last paragraph on three? Acts whose meaning is a norm.
Acts whose meaning is a norm can be performed in various ways. For example, by a gesture, the traffic policeman, by a motion of his arms, orders the pedestrian to stop or to continue. Or by a symbol, the red light constitutes a command for the driver to halt, a green light to proceed. Or by spoken or written words, either in the imperative form, be quiet, or in the form of an indicative statement, I order you to be silent. In this way, also, permissions or authorizations may be formulated. They are statements about the act whose meaning is a command, a permission, and authorization.
So there are lots of ways that you could convey this idea of a legal norm of an ought, right? It could be, you know, you could say it, you can demonstrate it, right? There are a lot of subways of doing it. So the actual medium, necessarily, of how it's conveyed isn't what's really the issue here. It's just identifying whatever your norm is. Dana, next paragraph.
If a man in need asks another man for help, the subjective meaning of this request is that the other ought to help him. But in an objective sense, he ought to help. That is to say, he is morally obliged to help. Only if a general norm, established, for instance, by the founder of a religion, is valid that commands, love your neighbor. And this latter norm is objectively valid only if it is presupposed that one ought to behave as the religious founder had commanded.
So this speaks exactly to what you know, a lot of your objections to the religious issue. This latter norm is objectively valid only if it is presupposed that one ought to behave as the religious leader commanded.
If the founder of Scientology said, give the founder of Scientology all your money.
It only makes sense if you agree a priori that the head of Scientology is someone worth listening to.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
That's why it's good to know a lot of different religions, so you can pick and choose.
Well,
no, not so much.
But that, I'll continue.
Such a presupposition, establishing the objective validity of the norms of a moral or legal order, will here be called a basic norm, ground norm.
Ground norm, yeah.
Therefore, the objective validity of a norm, which is the subjective meaning of an act of will that men
ought to.
Is it ought to?
Yes. Sorry. Yeah.
Ought to behave in a certain way does not follow from the factual
law.
Law.
Well, that is to say. Yeah, sorry. The issues with the OCR.
Yeah. From an is. Wait.
That is to say from an is, but again from a norm authorizing, that is to say from an ought. Meaning, again in plain English, the difference between is and ought, if a religious leader says, do X, right? That is an is statement. Guy said so. Factual statement. Now granted, I should also throw in a disclaimer here, that when it comes to Jewish like rabbis, you actually do have questions of is. Like when, someone cites, Rav Moshe says X, right? Normally that's an is statement by itself. Mm-hmm. But it's something that is quite debatable. Since I've been here, I have heard a lot of people quote Rav Moshe on a lot of things. I shouldn't say many of which, but enough of which has been unsubstantiated.
Lies, they say.
I wouldn't say people lie as much as would say people are. Well, I would say this. Some people do lie. Other people are misinformed. And there's a difference of if I know better, meaning if I listen to another rabbi and he says, Rav Moshe says, I'm going to trust what someone says, right? So if someone else repeats it, I would say that's more of being misinformed. If there is a rabbi who actually knows better, who says it without actually substantiating it, which happens plenty enough, or alternatively, people try to say, well, Rav Moshe said this, but here's what he really meant. It happens much worse with Rav Soloveitchik than with Rav Moshe. But it happens all the time. Where you don't think about here's what's written, here's what's really meant. So hold up. So that's a debate over the is. But you still have that implication of what ought to be. Meaning down here, when someone says Rav Moshe says X,
that's an is statement,
but for them the implication is an ought, which is ought to follow Rav Moshe.
Exactly.
Why? Because here it is
close to God.
We haven't gotten to why one ought to listen to Rav Moshe. Using the language of Kelsen, it's presupposed that one ought to behave as the religious. Here it says religious founder, but the religious leader commands. Who's a religious leader? We have a separate class on just dealing with Gedolim. But you can substitute any religious authority here of presuppose that you ought to listen to this particular person. Where do such presuppositions come from? And these are going to be questions that we're going to have to address, right? So let's say you presuppose that you follow the rabbis and the sages. Well, okay, what's the basis for that? What's the basis for following, say, Rav Moshe over Rav Ovadia Yosef, or over any other rabbi? Following Mishneh Berurah over Aruch HaShulchan, right? And that's even assuming that, all right, so what's, where...
Well,
what is the, so when you talk about what's the basis behind it, the reason why it's an important issue to address is that, let's say you reduce it all to the rabbinic statement, Aseh Lecha Rav, make for yourself a teacher. So, one, there's an implication here that the rabbi who said Aseh Lecha Rav is an authority worth listening to, right? So, and that is an assumption. The other thing is, then you're going to, in effect, reduce your matter of, faith or religious practice, right, of choosing your rabbi. In which case, the basis of rabbinic authority doesn't lie with the greatness of the rabbi, it relies on the arbitrary choice. So, you know, anyone can say, hey, I like this rabbi. I'm going to follow that rabbi. You're following us, Elcha Rav, right? But who is it that you're really following? Is it the rabbi? Well, no, but forget the reform rabbi. Who is it that you're really following? Are you following the rabbi or are you following yourself? Are you following your own options? Are you having more faith in what the rabbi says in the rabbi system? Or are you having faith in your own judgment that you happen to have chosen to follow this particular individual? It's a pretty big question right there. Right? The fact that you were raised in a certain time or place, the fact that you went to a certain yeshiva, does that make what you were told any more correct than what they study elsewhere?
Well,
there's always grounds for doubt, right?
Well, it's not just there are always grounds for doubt, but this is an important question. Yeah, you'll notice I'm asking a lot more questions than I'm going to answer in this particular class. But, you know, one of the reasons why I'm doing this is this lays the groundwork, but it also shows just how complicated these questions are. Yeah. The fact that I went to a yeshiva and was taught a certain way, so I'm born into a particular halachic observance, what is my faith really into? Then my faith isn't so much, well, this particular rabbi is more objectively correct in some way, as much as, well, you know, this is what I got. In which case, you know, what implications does that have also for your own personal practice versus dictating to others, right? Which is also a very important component here, because there are plenty of people out there, and we'll get to this in matters of rabbinic authority and who has the right to tell what. You know, I get, you know, random people say, oh, but isn't this the halacha? Right? You know, like, you know, ostensibly, well, I have smicha from YU. Maybe that means something, maybe it doesn't, right? But I got smicha. I look through sources and I'll say, oh, here's what you ought to do. And you have people who don't have smicha who say, this is what the halacha is. Read this source, read that source. Even before I got smicha, I'd quote Shulchan Aruch to people. And before I got smicha, people wouldn't take me seriously as much as after I got smicha. I quoted the exact same Shulchan Aruch. Shulchan Aruch didn't change in a span of 4 years. And so people listen one or the other, right? So what does that mean also? Like, well, there's something that I might choose to do, but then there's me dictating to what other people do. And believe me, people who don't have smicha dictate to rabbis, right? Well, you know, here's what a rabbi does. Or alternatively, people will pass judgment on other rabbis and say, well, you know, he does that, so therefore he, you know, must not be a Talmid Chacham. So is it really rabbinic authority? It's like, no, it's not even rabbinic authority so much as, well, you happen to pick a particular rabbi, that rabbi disagrees, so now you're also going to sit in judgment of the other rabbis, almost this extension of that one. Yeah.
Well, whatever happened, whatever happened to I got a guy?
Yeah, so when you say you got a guy, so let's say that word, it means like you've got your rabbi that you listen to.
Right. All right. I come here, I'm from B'nai Brak.
Yeah.
Or forget B'nai Brak, I'm from Los Angeles.
Yeah.
In Los Angeles, the particular Los Angeles congregation I'm from may not do things exactly the way they do them here. Mm-hmm. And somebody asks, why are you doing that? I got a guy.
Okay.
And so unless the guy says eating ham is okay, If we're staying within the norm,
Within the norm, just how much trouble you run into.
If we're staying within the universally accepted basics,
why does that matter?
Because there are certain things we can all agree on.
And what does universal agreement matter? And the truth is, there isn't. But, although, hold off on that. The fact is, if universal agreement, let me do the last paragraph. Because this actually gets into a little bit of the cultural element of norm. And I say cultural element of the norm because at the beginning, Kelsen actually makes an explicit distinction. When he describes law, he doesn't mean sociology of law, anthropology of law, he means law. I was talking to Dr. Jonathan Bayern about this over Shabbos, and he said when he was at Yale Law School, there was one teacher of his that just wanted to teach a class called law. Because not law of something, not, you know, something of law, just law. And it's kind of like a University of Chicago thing, that University of Chicago loves doing these interdisciplinary stuff. And I had this idea when I was there of almost like a game show of, like, you've got, you know, one topic of and another topic. And you spin the wheels, and you see what you come up with your dissertation. So you have the philosophy of calculus. Great! You know, or, you know, the sociology of biochem. and something like that, or, you know, the chemistry of sociology, and like whichever ones you wind up, boom, there's your thesis, and someone's going to have to do a whole bunch of interdisciplinary studies. I'm sure people could. I don't know if there's anyone listening to this from U of C. Take my advice and see what happens, because I'd be interested to see what comes up with that. But it would be a great U of C game show. Anyway, here's he continues. Norms according to which men ought to behave in a certain way can also be created by custom. So this goes to a bit what you were saying about universal agreement, as opposed to a norm which would, some would apply some sort of act. Universal agreement is more something that's more natural, more evolutionary, like just what people happen to do, as opposed to a specific act that people do. Because otherwise, it's not that you do it because everyone, you know, because everyone sat together, made a formal declaration, as much as there was some natural outgrowth, which is how people got there. If men who socially live to behave for some time, and under the same circumstances in the same way, then a tendency, that is psychologically a will, comes to exist into an existence within the men to behave as the members of the group habitually do. At first, the subjective meaning of the acts that constitute custom is not an ought. But later, when these acts have existed for some time, the idea arises in the individual member that he ought to behave in the manner which the members customarily behave, and at the same time, the will arises that the other members ought to behave in the same way. Meaning, after a while, a same group of people that you live together keep doing the same things, it almost naturally becomes an ought of, like, well, I ought to do what everyone else does. And by turn, everyone else ought to do the same things that everyone else does. I mean, it's something that you as a citizen feel compelled to conform, and you also have this expectation of conformity to everyone else in the group. If one member of the group does not behave in the manner which the other members customarily behave, then his behavior will be disapproved by others as contrary to their will. In this way, the custom becomes the expression of a collective will whose subjective meaning is an ought. However, the subjective meaning of the acts that constitute the custom can be interpreted as an objectively norm or only if the custom has been instituted as a by a higher as a norm creating fact. Since custom is constituted by human acts, even norms created by customs are created by acts of human behavior and are therefore like norms which are subjective meaning of legislative act posited or positive norms. Custom may create moral or legal norms. Legal norms are created by custom if the constitution of the social group institutes custom, a specifically defined custom, as a norm-creating fact. In other words, when you say everyone agrees, that only has weight if there's something external that defines everyone agrees as a norm-creating fact. So if you want to say everyone agrees because everyone agrees, that's now what you have a tautology.
One second. Don't kindle a fire anywhere you live on Shabbos.
Yeah.
That we can we universally agree that also means not turning on a light, not using not turning on an electric.
Not even a little. Not even a little.
We the Orthodox, we who define ourselves as Orthodox Jews, we cannot universally agree.
Which Shlomo Zalman Auerbach Orthodox?
I don't know who that is.
Oh, that's a fair point. Well, if you want to talk about the, you know, there was a huge debate over the, over electricity. We spent 4 weeks on that in its own right. It is really not simple at all that electricity is fire. In fact, there's a great piece in Richard Feynman, one of his memoirs. I'm blanking on which one. I'll have to find it. He goes to JTS. And because people at JTS asked him about electricity, and he was so excited that rabbinical students want to know about, you know, physics. And he was so disappointed when the only thing they asked him was, is electricity fire, because of their arcane sabbatical laws. And he explained, like, how electricity isn't fire. And he constructed a circuit how it couldn't possibly be fire. He also concludes the story how he went back to pick fights with them over theology and got out-reasoned by Talmudic logic, and he was very bitter at that.
Nice.
This is a noble art. It's a great, great passage.
It's great that he wrote about that admission.
I recommend, if people can read Richard Feynman, we actually have a letter, a book of his letters up there that were compiled by, I think, his either granddaughter or niece, some relative.
What's the name of the book?
I don't know the name of the book, but he's good enough And it's worthwhile reading. Richard Feynman, F-E-Y-N-M-A-N.
F-E-Y-N-M-A-N. Okay.
Yeah, the book that we actually have in the show is Perfectly Reasonable Deviations from the Beaten Track, Letters of Richard P. Feynman. And some of them are really, really fascinating. That's a bit of a digression. How do we get off on that? Let me answer your question this way.
Universal.
Let's take aside universal issues. Here's an argument that I've used in the past. I don't recall here. When it comes to, say, laws of Eruvin, right? There are very few Eruvin in the world that are halachically kosher by the definition set up in the Gemara. There are a whole bunch of other reasons why, you know, people not going to go into laws of Eruvin, but they are not halachically kosher based on the criteria set up in the Gemara. Why do people use Eruvin? Well, usually it's a combination of two reasons. One, a rabbi said it was okay, and two, the community does it. And by a rabbi says it's okay, we're using rabbi in the broad sense of the term, not just a local rabbi, but, you know, rabbinic authorities down the line are people whom are considered rabbinic authorities. Now, let's take it to another scenario. The conservative movement ruled years ago that it is permitted to drive to synagogue on Shabbat. So if I'm a conservative Jew, my rabbis say it's okay. My community does it. Am I violating Shabbat? Now, keep in mind, Rabbi Jacob Agus, when he wrote the response, he didn't just pull it out of the ether. He actually gave a halachic reason for why it could be permitted to drive to synagogue on Shabbat, actually based on Tosafot. Not going to get into the details now. It's worthwhile reading it. We can argue whether or not he was correct or incorrect, but that, you know, also begs the question of how do we determine what's correct? At the end of the day, my rabbis say it's okay. The rabbis that I was brought up to respect as halakhic authority say that it's valid. My community does it. Would this not be okay? Ultimately, it's the exact same argument that Orthodox, you know, Jews do for the stuff that they do. Right? So what's your standard behind it? If you're saying, well, only my rabbi's okay and your rabbis are not okay, where do you get that definition from? What is the criteria by which you base it?
Depends which way you want to jump.
Partially. The real thing is that
the rabbis that you like what they say.
Well, so the real issue that I see is there's an unfortunate confusion within, you know, the Orthodox world of making an identity issue between what people do and what the laws say, and that things are used kind of interchangeably, or things are used almost inconsistently when you try to ask for anything of a systematic halacha. And there are going to be different approaches to this. So, I mean, this is going to be an oversimplification, but one approach is, well, you assume what people are doing and have done is correct. That's going to be your baseline. And then you work backwards trying to justify how did we get to this point. Another approach is you start from the top down. And that's going to be how we're going to start here and to see where did other things develop. In which case you're going to reach conclusions that say, well, what they do in this particular time and place isn't halakhically valid. Right? And there are a whole lot of assumptions that are going to come up and we're going to deal with all of them. So I don't believe we're going to meet next week, but the week afterwards we're going to get to, really start at the very beginning in terms of, well, you know, assuming that, you know, God gives the Torah, God wants us to do things, we're going to start with God and then work our way down through the rabbinic period and spend a lot of time in the rabbinic period, see how that developed, and go through a bunch of, you know, either topics or concepts about, you know, how Jewish law, you know, operates, both, you know, theory, practice, and certain of the, a lot of these implications that come up, and hopefully we'll come up with something. Now, I should say, I have my own bias, and I will try to, well, not mitigate the bias as much as try to explain other ways as best as I can, and in doing so, try to unpack all of the assumptions behind it. So we'll do a class specifically on minhag. You know, on custom. You're dealing with Kelson's last paragraph there of the of the norms of custom, right? Of like people do it. Where does that come from? So we're going to describe that at least from, you know, the rabbinic mindset. Is that what people do? Well, yes. Now we're going to see different sides of that. Now I've got my own take of it because I have my own, you know, tradition, which, you know, we can all take and leave. But we're going to try to unpack that thing of, well, when people say you ought to do it, what is the basis for it, and to try to justify it? And if you say that the reason why you do it is simply because people do it, realize at least that that's a tautology, and realize that you haven't really given any new information. You're effectively arguing, you know, do this because, you know, we said so. But that also means by deep implication that what you do is in fact what God wants. And there was a guy from NYU who argued that a couple of years ago. More than a couple of years ago. I was in Chicago at the time. Here was this situation. There was a journal called Beit Yitzchak, which was a Hebrew journal put out by the YU rabbinic, it's published by the rabbinical school. And it's got articles from Rosh Yeshiva and articles from, you know, students. And there was a guy who wrote a piece that allegedly came out that the prohibition of Lo Tirtzach, of don't murder, doesn't apply to non-Jews. Meaning, if a Jew murders... Well, the argument was, if you murder a non-Jew, you aren't halachically in violation of Lo Tirtzach. It was a ridiculous piece, and it got out, and people were just trashing it, and, you know, it was even one person, you know, quoted. So, you mean that according to your interpretation of Maimonides, you're allowed to kill a non-Jew, but you're not allowed to steal from him? You know, it was a crazy... But he had another piece in there that I thought was a lot more troubling. And in fact, what he argued was that God is an intrinsic part of the halachic process, such that God wouldn't allow Jews to make mistakes. Whatever Jews happen to do is therefore, by definition, the correct interpretation of the Torah. And he took it a step further. It says all the opinions that we don't actually practice are therefore not on the same level as Torah.
And infallibility of the Pope.
This is more than just infallibility of the Pope. It's infallibility of the Jewish community. It's what we do is right and is Torah QED. Now, I argued vociferously against that, and I, you know, also tried saying, like, you're arguing over the stupid article. This is not only dumber, but a lot more harmful, because, you know, this person's, I mean, he is a rabbi now. And, you know, he's out doing stuff, and if he still believes this way, and by means still believes this way, is it's not uncommon for people, you know, in college or even in rabbinical school to say stupid stuff and to publish things before they're ready. So I'm like, you know, when he said, you know what, maybe you just didn't know any better, you know, grew off, especially more, you know, philosophy. I can give him a pass, but if he still believes this way and he's actually a rabbi of a shul and actually going to influence other people, yeah, I'd be a little bit concerned right there.
Are you sure it wasn't tongue-in-cheek, like the guy who did the postmodern article?
No. This was not tongue-in-cheek at all. I can't give him the benefit of the doubt on this one. He actually meant what he said. But anyway. So, we're not going to... Let me just double-check the... Yeah, I think that's right. I can, you know, send emails just to make sure, but I believe, yeah, next week won't... be here a week afterwards. Well, yeah, no, it's not the 20th. It's the 13th. The 13th is next week's Mother's Day. All right, so now I'm not going to be here, but, you know, the rest of the weeks will be fine. It'll be 1 week at the beginning of June. Other than that, regular Sunday schedule. So
the internet rally is the
20th. Yes, the internet rally is the 20th, which. I'm personally not going to be going to, but anyone else may.
There's a great counter-rally that's being organized.
Why would it be a counter-rally? I would assume the great counter-rally would be in, like, you know, Twitter hashtag. You know, and I'm sure people are going to go to live tweet it, and they'll come up with a hashtag. Normally I'd say Google+, but, you know, no one actually uses that. Anyway, have a great week. Be well.